Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 this Sunday, November 7th, 2010. We've got a great show for you today. As our news media struggle in crisis with resources and controversy, there is a burgeoning new media that's coming along to fill the void or even complement the void or do whatever, but create a whole new space and a whole new type of journalism online and in electronic media. We're going to be meeting today and talking today with one of the founders and creators of this new wave of journalism. Paul Jay from The Real News will be joining us today for the full hour, so sit back, relax, and have a great time. In the meantime, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
On November 16th, folks in New Mexico will be gathering in Albuquerque for a public hearing to share their ideas, experiences, and concerns about internet access and online freedom. Federal Communications Commissioner Michael Copps will be at the hearing to listen to the public testimony. Across the mostly rural state, half of the population lacks a broadband connection, and many people are concerned that the FCC will fail to protect net neutrality. The hearing coincides with the National Congress of American Indians' 67th Annual Convention and Trade Show. Andrea Quijada, executive director of the Media Literacy Project in New Mexico, said this is the perfect opportunity for Native people, the Latino community, and people of color, the most disconnected populations in the country, to express their concerns.
Our primary goal with the hearing is to ensure that New Mexicans are included in the decision-making process of the FCC and that the stories that New Mexicans share have the impact on the FCC to reclassify broadband and to ensure net neutrality.
Quijada said a broadband connection is vital for rural communities to access health information, as well as distance learning and economic opportunities. She said anyone with a story to tell about digital exclusion and online freedom should come to the hearing.
We often hear stories of people who can't participate in terms of even applying for a grant, to applying for food stamps, to be able to monitor and update their immigration status, that so much of even government work is now e-government that people often need to access the internet for basic day-to-day activities. We absolutely need to hear from anyone who has those stories.
Other speakers at the event include Loris Taylor, Executive Director of Native Public Media, Joe Garcia, Chairman of the All Indian Pueblo Council, Amalia Deloney of the Center for Media Justice, and Jeffrey Blackwell from the FCC Office of Native Affairs and Policy. Free Press, Media Literacy Project, and the Center for Media Justice are co-hosting the hearing. For more information, visit savetheinternet.com or call 877-888-1533, extension 207.
Comcast increased political giving by half since announcing its proposal to buy NBC Universal. The cable giant is seeking federal approval for the merger, which would combine the nation's largest cable operator and residential broadband provider with a national broadcast network and all its subsidiaries, dozens of cable channels, local TV stations, websites, and the Universal Movie Studio. According to records at the Federal Election Commission, Comcast gave $1.1 million to federal candidates and political parties from the time the deal was reached in December 2009 through August 2010. That was up from $682,000 in the same period 2 years earlier. Comcast is now sixth on the list of the biggest spending corporations. Although a Comcast spokesperson called the numbers a modest uptick, consumer watchdog Mark Cooper describes the contribution dollars differently. Cooper is the director of research at the Consumer Federation of America.
Corporations give a lot of money all the time. But Comcast, the numbers I've seen of the number of people they've supported, is extraordinary. Three-quarters of the House representatives have received Comcast contributions.
In a letter to the Federal Communications Commission, 99 House members urged the agency to approve the merger. Of those 99 House members, 91 received donations from Comcast. Cooper says that the amount of contributions correlates to the number of signers.
The difference between those who sent the letters and those who didn't in terms of getting support was statistically significant. I've never seen that before. A very high percentage of the people who signed these letters also got money. Now, they insist that doesn't matter, but the truth is that if you got money from Comcast, you were much more likely to send a letter than if you didn't.
Comcast is pouring money into Congress, hoping to seek quick federal approval of the merger. Comcast is hoping its acquisition of NBC will give it an advantage in the growing online video market. But in reality, it will give it incentive to stifle competition from online video. Although merger approval comes from the FCC and the Department of Justice, the name of the game is to show where the political muscle lies.
It's bank shot lobbying, right? You try and get these guys to speak in public, even though neither the FCC nor the DOJ is supposed to listen to the Congress when it comes to doing this stuff.
Cooper says that the only thing that will stop this kind of excessive money flowing through Capitol Hill is a change of public perspective. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, November 7, 2010, here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Paul Jay, who's the senior editor and I think founder of the Real News Network, which can be found online at therealnews.com, who's been an active journalist for decades now and formerly was the executive producer of the Canadian Broadcast Corporation's News World debate program, Counterspin. He's an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and we're honored to have him as our guest today. Paul Jay, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Bob.
Well, Paul, before we get too much into it, just for the sake of listeners who might not be familiar with the Real News Network or therealnews.com, can you just give a brief summary of its history, its origins, and its purpose?
No, sorry. Let me apologize in advance for a dry, nagging cough. I hope I don't drive people crazy. I was, as you mentioned, producing the daily debate show on CBC for about a decade. After 9/11, the lead up to the war in Iraq, the first Afghan war, then Iraq, it became clear that there needed to be some kind of way to break the political pressure that could be put on newsrooms in the U.S. and in Canada. Canadian news was a little better on Iraq, but it wasn't really any better on the Afghan war. So the idea was that the Internet and direct funding from viewers in the way the Internet could add something new to that, and we saw that from the Howard Dean campaign, and of course since then many more such campaigns, that we could directly fund and break the pressure that advertisers have or corporate underwriting or government funding. So essentially the Real News is about a new economic model for doing daily news, no government funding, no corporate funding, no reliance on advertising. Right now we do daily video news on the web, and we're planning to move to TV sometime in the next few months. First with a show and then with a channel. The aim is to have a 24/7 news channel on TV and online that competes with mainstream news channels.
Paul Jay, if you're not getting money from private investors, from advertisers, from government, as most news media do, even community radio, for example, gets a certain percentage of its money from in the United States from federal government, from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Where are you getting it?
Right now, you know, from viewer donations is the majority of our funding, you know, $10 and $20. We have a few bigger donors, and interesting enough, almost all the bigger donors just found us online, started watching, and then gave us, you know, a significant contribution. We get some from foundations, but it's probably less than about 15% now. But we're also going to be starting something new, which is a merchandising model. And the idea is we don't want to sell advertising because advertisers can pressure you in ways that everyone listening to this show, I'm sure, understands. But we will sell stuff. And so we're developing now a model that will complement the donor stream with a merchandising stream, essentially selling items that we're calling green, fair trade, or union-made. And we're asking people, before they buy anything, see if you can't buy it green, fair trade, or union-made. So we will have a merchandising model to complement the donor stream.
Paul Jay, you are both Canadian and American. You hold two passports.
Right.
And one of the features of the Real News Network, which I think is unique, is that it's really while it's English language, it's very much a transnational news report in the sense that it's not sort of tied to a single nation state. Is that a fair assessment?
In principle, it's a fair statement. In terms of long-term objective, it's a fair statement. But in the short term, we are a little more focused on an American audience, partly from the point of view of people who live in the U.S. and from outside. What happens in the U.S. so affects the rest of the world that we think getting traction amongst Americans is in global interest. So if you live in the Roman Empire, you want to know what Rome is doing. So we do have a specific focus on the U.S., and we're going to have an even more specific focus. We're picking one city in the U.S. that we're going to start putting a lot of focused effort into, and that's going to be Baltimore. We're going to be going. Sorry, go ahead.
Why didn't you consider Champaign or Urbana?
Because you're not close enough to Washington. We want to be. We're accredited journalists on Capitol Hill now, which was one of the weirder feelings I had walking through the Senate and the House and seeing security guards come and look at my pass and say, "Oh, okay," and walking wherever we pleased. I mean, I've been a journalist for a long time, but I still found that a little strange. So we're going to go back and forth between covering Congress and speaking to the people of Baltimore and through the people of Baltimore to ordinary Americans. We're calling it the Real Baltimore and picking up where the wire left off. In other words, taking local issues but following the trail of facts to why things are happening and what the solutions are to systemic national answers. Because one of the biggest problems is most people still watch local news, and there's this kind of artificial wall between local news and national and systemic issues. They're treated as if they're on different planets. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as we know, if the reason cities are running out of money and teachers are getting laid off and cops' overtime are being canceled and there's garbage in the streets and rats on the sidewalks and houses boarded up, which are... We met with a class of students at Morgan State University in Baltimore, and those were the three or four things they asked. When we said, what would you like us to do stories on, the first four were essentially, why are so many houses boarded up? Why is there garbage and rats around the sidewalks? Another good one is, why are tuitions going up when the services being offered in the university haven't changed? So we're going to take up these day-to-day questions, but along with an audience, work through a process that gets to systemic, national, and even global answers.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, is Paul Jay, the senior editor for the Real News Network, which you can find online at therealnews.com. And you can get emailed the daily sort of blast and updates of the news stories if you want. Sign up very easily at therealnews.com. I do it. I've been getting it every day. And that's why I wanted Paul Jay in the show. It's really breaking a lot of stories you're not going to get elsewhere in the news media with tremendous professionalism as well. Before we go back into some of the stories you've been covering, Paul Jay, and some of the stories the realnews.com and the Real News Network are covering, I wanted you to reflect for something you did mention. It's on your website, a big story that broke Friday, which is the suspension of Keith Olbermann for making campaign contributions to a few candidates and not getting the permission of MSNBC bosses to do so. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm old school. I come from a CBC tradition where certainly publicly journalists at CBC and in the old school journalist tradition were barred from any kind of participation in partisan politics. And I think that's legitimate. I think there needs to be a differentiation whether someone is supposed to be doing news or doing punditry and opinion. If they're clearly just opinion pundits, then I don't think they need to be under the same set of rules. But if you're supposed to be doing news, then I think you should not just overtly, but even as much as one can subjectively, try to stay out of the direct partisan fray. So I'm a little betwixt and between. I know the hypocrisy in this whole question on many networks.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, in some ways, the most honest about it is Fox. I mean, Fox is clearly just is the TV arm of the Republican Party, and more than the Republican Party, the TV arm of the far right of the Republican Party. But they also don't make any bones about it. So I know it's hypocritical, but Oberman should have known better.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think this is an important question. When you were at the CBC, was it only the working journalists or the on-air people who were required to sort of maintain a formal public neutrality, or did it apply to their managers, the people who hired and fired them?
It was supposed to be anybody that had editorial control.
Mm-hmm.
So managers, yes. Technicians, no.
Yeah, the reason I was asking is that, you know, in our news media, we just had a report on the newscast right before you came on air, Paul. Comcast, which is about to take over MSNBC, its corporate executives have made extraordinarily large donations to the Republican Party to get favorable policies for it. And General Electric has done the same thing, which currently owns MSNBC. But no one. It's interesting that it's not an issue that the actual person who owns the company is held to the same standards as the news media personnel they hire and fire.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I mean, at CBC, of course, it's a public broadcaster. So it's a little different in the sense that, and this is also a big problem for CBC, the entity that appoints the president to the CBC is the office of the prime minister. So you can't get more partisan than that, and that's been a terrible problem for CBC, that the presidents are often former bagmen for whichever party has to be in power, and certainly are considered not just politically reliable in a broad sense, but even often in a partisan sense. So it's a good point. As a journalist myself, I know I wouldn't give money to any party, and I'm even wary of voting, to be honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I think the most important thing probably in it all is to be at least transparent about it. Oberman obviously supports the Democratic Party at least as opposed to the Republican Party, so I guess he's transparent about that. But if I was interviewing someone I was about to or had given money to, I think I should have at least said something to that extent. I mean, maybe that's really the bigger issue. Like Oberman should have said, you know, I'm interviewing X now, and just to be fair, everyone should know I gave him $500 or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Our guest today, Paul Jay, you've been listening to from TheRealNews.com, the Real News Network, senior editor there. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters with a question or comment for Paul Jay, the phone number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. I want to spend much of the show today, starting right now, going over some of the stories you cover, how you cover them that's different from the mainstream commercial news media or public news media in the United States, and some of the stories that you think aren't getting enough attention that need even more than you're able to provide them. And I think the place I'd like to start is one of the stories that I get a lot of information from your site that I don't get as much, which is coverage of the economy and the economic situation in the United States, ironically, given its centrality to our lives. I find story after story on the Real News Network featuring oftentimes American economists that I simply don't see hardly anywhere else.
Well, as I said, we're probably 90% of what we're doing now is American, and will be for a while. We actually now live in the Washington area, and we have an office that we worked out a deal with the McClatchy newspaper chain, and we're in their offices downtown. But the economy is clearly, both objectively and in terms of what's affecting people and their feelings and opinions, is the story right now. What we're trying to do is answer two questions for ordinary people, and this is our mission now. We need to be able to help people understand what's happening to me and what I can do about it. And the starting point to answer those questions for any journalist is you have to recognize something that we all know, but I would say the vast, vast majority of the media, including a lot of progressive media, don't talk about, and certainly mainstream media try not to recognize. And that's, we live in a class society. It seems radical to say something like that, and it's ridiculous that it sounds radical. During every election campaign, we hear both parties usually, but certainly the Democratic Party the most, including President Obama, we're going to fight for the middle class. And after he got elected, he appointed Joe Biden as head of a special commission to fight for the middle class. Well, if there's a middle class, there's got to be a lower and an upper. And if you've got a lower, a middle, and an upper, and maybe some other strata, that's called a class society, which means if you're going to talk about economics, you have to say for whom. And when President Obama campaigns, you know, there's no red states, no blue states, only the United States. Or when the unions organize a rally called One Nation, it's a real distortion of a reality that anyone that works for a living, especially if you're poor, but anyone that has a daily working job, knows that there is not one America. And the way Edwards formulated it wasn't so bad, that there's two Americas. And in a blog I did recently, and I know people that watch The Real News know I quote this all the time, George Will had a wonderful quote in the before the November 08 election. He was on the Stephanopoulos show, and he was having an argument with Donna Brazile. And Brazile was going on about how John McCain has seven houses, and how could he understand what ordinary people need or want. And Will was getting redder and redder in the face. And I guess all your listeners know George Will is this conservative.
Well, he happens to be from Champaign-Urbana, so he's a native son of sorts.
Okay, well, maybe what he says will even have more credibility. Anyway, so Will finally explodes, and he says, listen, FDR was from the American aristocracy, and you know, which goes to the core of the mythology of your party, meaning the Democrats. And then then he goes on, and the exact quote is, he says, surely in a democracy, it's time for us to quit being sentimental and say the question we settle in an election is not whether elites shall rule, but which elites shall rule. Now, that to me is the core of whether you're going to do, Will said that as an anomaly only because he got angry. He would never normally say such a thing. But all journalists know this is the truth. So if you're going to do journalism that really gets at the facts of things, you have to decide, are you with the elites or not? Because the Wall Street Journal, for example, they make no bones about it. You know, they do business journalism for the elites, and you'll sometimes find the most honest, realistic journalism in these business sections of papers or in something like the Wall Street Journal, because they're really trying to be more objective. Like, how can I make money out of this situation? The thing is, for the rest of us, we're not on that side of the equation. So a journalist has to decide, who is your audience? And if your audience are ordinary people, then are you actually going to try to do journalism in their interests, in their economic interests, or not? So we've made that decision. That's what we're going to do. And that's who our audience is, and that's the way we do economic news. It's not that we're trying to be propagandists. If it turns out that some particular... Well, I'll give you a good example. It's a very interesting one. Just last night, we were driving to Boston, and we stopped a couple hours out, and we went to a Japanese restaurant in one of these strip malls, and they had one of these cooking tables. You know, the guy comes out, mm-hmm. and he throws his knives in the air and honks a horn and squirts sake out of some crazy squirting thing into people's mouths, which was I found a little demeaning, so I didn't do it. But anyway, so we're sitting at this table, and you get to talk to people you haven't met before, and we're next to this couple. And this one guy works at a factory that has close to 3,000 employees, and they make grinding wheels. And it's a French-owned company with plants all over the world. This is one of their bigger plants, like an hour and a half outside of Boston. And he's going on about how they had 100 jobs available, and they could only fill 50 of them. So I said, why? And he says, because too many people, you know, in the area are unemployment insurance. And it's not worth it to them to work when they can sit at home and collect. And I said, well, how much are you paying? So he said, $13.25 an hour. And I said, okay, so you mean if sort of, so at some point, so anyway, let's just take that first piece. So the first piece is unemployment insurance is creating a situation where even when there are some jobs free, and we know there is an objective unemployment problem, but we hear a lot of this thing that unemployment insurance is stopping people from working. So here's a guy telling me this is true, and I think there's a tendency on the left to dismiss this thing. But it's a real issue in certain areas where it is easier to stay on unemployment insurance than go get a job. So $13.25 an hour, the unemployment rate, something like $7.50, maybe $8. I'm not sure what it is in Massachusetts, but it's going to be somewhere between $7.50 and $8.25. So I said, well, I guess you're going to have to raise your wages. And he looked at me kind of askance. He's in middle management. And I said, well, I guess we will. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? What's so bad? Yeah, maybe unemployment insurance is better to stay at home. So maybe it's a good thing that unemployment insurance may force a rise in wages in order to compete with it, to make it worth it to go to work. But won't that help increase real consumer demand in the economy? And he looked and he said, well, yeah, maybe you got something. Because he doesn't own the place. He's middle management.
Yeah.
So I said, listen, I'm just curious, you know, when you started work, this guy's like ready to retire now. I said, when you started work, and he was in the early 70s, I think he started in 70, 71. I said, what were you making, starting wage? He said, oh, I think I started about $10 an hour. Well, I just quickly did a calculation before the interview. I went to this website that does the inflation calculation. $10 an hour of purchasing power. If you wanted to earn the same amount today as then, would be $55.20 an hour.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
So we got when I said that to him, and like his eyes rolled. He said, you know, like if the problem is that economics is being covered from the point of view of investors. It's being covered from the point of trying to cover up what's going on Wall Street. And there's this kind of argument, which is really just old trickle-down economics. Reagan, you know, what George Bush 1 called voodoo economics, is being dressed up as something oppositional and radical and called Tea Party economics and smaller government and less taxes. I think the problem is that most journalists who are working, certainly for mainstream press, they won't focus on what do ordinary working people really need to know, because their newsrooms, the culture just isn't there. Their predominant audience and the editors, it's all about positioning this from the point of view of the political debate between Democrats and Republicans. It's not about analyzing what's really in people's interest.
Paul Jay, along those lines, it seems that one of the problems our journalists have covering the economy is that they're bounded by what people in power are debating. And so that sort of sets the terms of what can the legitimate range of questioning and inquiry. And both the Republicans and now President Obama, more or less based on President Obama's recent statements, accept the argument that the budget deficit is a primary cause of economic stagnation and decline, and that sort of job one is to get that squared away. And that seems to contradict most economists, or many economists, who, you know, argue that, you know, we're in serious default or lack of demand that's leading to a global depression, and that, you know, trying to address the deficit will only make that problem worse. Yet as journalists, our journalists are sort of caught, it seems, trapped between that range of narrow legitimate debate.
Yeah. Well, first in terms of the range of debate, is defined by the leadership of the two parties, never mind the two parties. Like, remember when John Conyers went, I think it was to Ohio after the 2004 elections, and did a report on possible election fraud. He went with 12 congressmen and issued a big book, a fat book of report of many, many examples of potential fraud and election manipulation. If I understand it correctly, I think Keith Olbermann was the only person in mainstream media to report on the fact they issued this result, the study and the investigation. There's not a single news source other than Olbermann picked it up. And so you've got to be at the top level of leadership, because journalists are really only unless business journalists are covering it from the point of view, how do I invest my money? And there you get more real analysis. Otherwise, most journalists are just interested in the horse race. You're either positioned to have real power or you're not. If you're not, you're not a story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you get that to economics, some other factors kick in, which is the where is public opinion and where will you look like you might have a left agenda? This is all rooted in the Cold War. It's all rooted in the House of Un-American Activities Committee. It's all rooted in almost 100 years, because the first, you know, Red Scare wasn't, as you know, post-World War II. The first Red Scare was post-Russian Revolution. So there's decades and decades in mainstream political culture, and particularly after House of Un-American Activities Committee. I mean, the last time you had somebody really overtly progressive at any real level of power would have been Vice President Wallace, and once he was gone, that was McCarthyism and the rest comes in, and that's the end of it. So I had a conversation with a guy who's a national economics reporter from one of the main newspapers. And off camera, we have conversations, Bob, the way you and I would have conversations about the economy. And I said, well, how come you don't say these things? Like, why aren't you writing this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
He says, I can. I said, if you seem to be going so far away from where the pack is, and he used, you know, journalist pack, you'll be done for. He says, you'll just be seen as having your own agenda, and you won't be taken seriously, you'll be marginalized, and that'll be the end of it. So for their own personal career reasons, for many, and then for others, there only is one game in town. It's the elite game. And you play that game because there is no real political representation right now of any significance. There is some, but it doesn't have enough force to contend for power of the non-elite, of ordinary people, of working people, whatever. There's just no force. So they say, well, if there's no real political force, it's just not a factor. And the elite game is the only game in town. And then if you're going to play that game, then you have to stay within the confines of what's considered legitimate opinion.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Paul Jay, the chairman of the board, or the chair of the board and CEO and senior editor of the Real News Network, which you can find at therealnews.com and will be a television program and soon channel. But go to realnews.com and therealnews.com, and you can see what they're doing right now. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Paul Jay, the phone number here at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a patient caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Paul Jay.
Hi. I wanted to, mention two things, and as regards the economics discussion or lack of it, I don't know whether this was the Stiglitz interview that Amy Goodman did, but I heard him say that 1% of the GDP of the U.S. has been paid to corporate, out in corporate bonuses, and I guess it's the last calendar year or whatever their cycle or fiscal year is. It's an astonishing figure that seems like should come from other people's mouths. Stiglitz, you know, should be interviewed more because he was bandied about as a possible person for the Obama economics team. That was a dream, I guess. The other thing I wanted to bring up is, in view of your recent talk, Bob, about Baltimore, maybe you could reprise the study that I think it was Pew that did it.
That's right.
About how stories are peddled and bandied about and who controls what the agenda is, and I think Baltimore is probably a fairly good sample of that. I don't know if the speaker is familiar with that as well, but I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you. And Paul Jay, I think you are familiar with this because you interviewed me for the Real News Network a few months ago with John Nichols, and I think this came up in our conversation, which is the Pew Center study of Baltimore's news ecology from last year, which showed that the amount of original news stories being generated by media in general was primarily from the Baltimore Sun Daily newspaper, and that it had fallen 30% in the last decade and 70% from 20 years ago. There's just much less original reporting going on in Baltimore. I know you're familiar with that.
Yeah, from what you were saying, from my interview with you, I knew it. Yeah.
And the other part of that,
it used to be considered one of the really good papers.
And the other part of that too, which I'll say before we go to our next caller, is that. But it also found that I thought was even more striking was this huge increase in the percentage of original news stories in Baltimore that came pretty much directly from public relations or official sources or press releases. You know, a much smaller percentage, I think it was 14%, come from a reporter and editor going out and saying, let's cover this and dig into it and find out what's going on, rather than waiting for a press release, and more or less, as the Pew Center study showed, just printing it or running it verbatim almost. Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest, Paul Jay, the head of the realnews.com, the Real News Network, taking your calls today at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at Media Matters. Let's go now to line two. Edgar County, you're on the air with Paul Jay.
Good afternoon. I think I could speak to something that happened locally this last Wednesday in Champaign-Urbana. So the local TV station reported that in a county election in Edgar County that an African-American had been elected the sheriff, only the second in Illinois, and they had a news crew down here and interviewed him picking up his signs and talking about being elected. Well, the fact of the matter is at the same time on the front page of the Beacon News here in Paris, above the fold, the county clerk had announced that because there was only 28 vote difference between the two candidates out of 7,036 votes, that she was not declaring a winner, and it would not be known until all the ballots, including absentee, had been, you know, counted on November 18th. This was on the 6 o'clock news. I called during the program and told them about the results and what was in the newspaper. Nothing was said. They reran it at 10 o'clock. I called again. They did nothing about it, and they reran it the next morning. So obviously, you know, they could have called the county clerk to find out. They could have read the online Beacon News, but they chose to run their story.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller, for that. Paul Jay, do you have any comment on that?
Well, it's hard to know what the specifics of that is. I mean, it just sounds like not very good, not very competent journalism.
We've never heard of that with television news, local TV news. That's a shocker.
Yeah.
Before we go to our next caller, I just remind folks for listening to Paul Jay. Paul, we've got a caller waiting, but I do want to ask you to make sure we get to this point. One of the issues that, as you said, started the coverage of the Real News Network, that really motivated you to get started, was the way the press covered the build-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And this has been a big story, Iraq and Afghanistan, for TheRealNews.com, the Real News Network, since your founding. What do you bring to the coverage of Afghanistan and Iraq and the U.S. role there that we would not necessarily find on CNN or PBS or NBC or the New York Times?
Well, I guess we're constantly trying to understand better why the U.S. is in Afghanistan. What is the real mission and what's the real objective? It's not a simple answer, and it's not just to snatch resources, or it's not just to fight Islamic extremists. Sometimes when I answer something like this, I ask people, why do you love the person you're partnered with if you have a partner? And there's never one reason. There's a lot of reasons for doing things. And if that's true between two individuals, imagine what it is when you're talking geoeconomics and geopolitics. But there is a conversation that goes on in Washington and in capitals around the world. that set the level of the grand chessboard. And one of the great, you know, books to read about this, if you want to understand some of this thinking, is Zbigniew Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard. And I interviewed Brzezinski, I guess it's about a year ago now. There is a level of rivalry that takes place, as we know, that led to World War I and led to World War II. And this geopolitical rivalry amongst big powers for their positioning, and particularly an American agenda post-World War II, which said there should be no superpower other than us, and their biggest mission was to make sure that the Soviet Union was no longer one. And that post-Soviet Union, the number one mission is to make sure there's never another one. That discourse goes on, but it doesn't go on publicly. So we try to understand in its complexity why the Iraq War took place, why the Afghan War took place, what is geopolitical objectives of U.S. foreign policy, and do that in a way that always we again ask, for whom? It's not a simple question why there's a $1 trillion military budget until you start saying who benefits from a trillion dollar military budget. Does it help ordinary people or not? And to some extent, you could say it could. Like, again, you could say for much of this century, U.S. domestic policy was to share a little bit of the wealth that came from being the dominant world power with American workers and ordinary people here. You could say there was some benefit from empire, from those people living in the U.S. compared to those people that didn't. So we need to be honest about that, but we also need to look at what's happening now, which it looks like they no longer want to share with American people because they seem so weak politically, the unions are so weak, that now they can start to try to force living and wages and living conditions of Americans closer to that of people who are being pushed around outside the United States. Anyway, what we bring to it is this kind of an inquiry.
One of the things that was striking about this last election, Paul Jay, in the United States, was that the United States is now in two what looks like semi-permanent wars, major wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or the Iraq war is winding down probably involuntarily to some extent, but we have a huge military presence there. And yet in the campaign, the 2010 campaign, the war virtually was non-existent as a debate issue. And, you know, it's really almost, it gives one pause to think about, you know, how a country can now be engaged in two long-term major wars and not even have it be a political issue in the country.
Well, I did a blog, you and I talked about a little bit about the six reasons, the six ways the Democrats helped the Republicans rebrand themselves with the Tea Party. And this is one of the six. There were two unholy alliances that took place over this election campaign and to some extent over the last 2 years. The first was the alliance between President Obama and the Republican Party to squelch any opposition to the Afghan war. People within the Democratic Party caucus, progressive caucus in the House and some in the Senate, who really wanted to question the whole reasons for the Afghan wars, many of them wanted it to end, wanted the U.S. out, they had no voice because the Republican Party allied with the right wing of the Democratic Party to make sure that this could never be talked about. So it became a non-issue in the election because the Republicans took it away as an issue, took it out as an issue. It did something else that was interesting that helped the Republicans, and I don't know if they had figured all this out or it just happened this way. But when Karl Rove and the far right of the Republican establishment adopted, financed, assimilated the Tea Party leadership, particularly people like Rand Paul, they took that away as an issue as well. Because Rand Paul, as we know, you know, his father Ron Paul, but I interviewed Rand in New Hampshire when his father was running for the Republican nomination for president in 2008. Rand was as vigorous in his opposition to U.S. empire, to the two wars, to the military budget, as his father Ron was. But they took that away because it became a non-issue in the election. So they allowed this Karl Rove section of the Republican Party to make alliances with the Tea Party instead of the Democrats being able to try to split them by taking on the question of the war. So it's on a political level, and of course journalists won't say anything. I mean, mainstream journalists simply, they may comment on it once here and there, but if it's not in play, they won't talk about it. So it's really an astounding example of what's wrong with the politics and the media, that you can be fighting two wars and not even talk about it in an election. And then, of course, the other two, other than war, the other two words that were never barely mentioned were climate change.
Yeah. Well, before we go to that issue, let's go back to our phone lines. Our guest again, Paul Jay, the senior editor from TheRealNews.com or The Real News Network. You can call and speak with him here at WILL at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Let's go to someone who's been waiting very patiently. I hope they're still with us. Line 3, Chicago, if you're, or Champaign, excuse me. You're on the air with Paul Jay.
Yes, Champaign. Can you hear me okay?
Hear you great.
Great. Two comments, one on unemployment, but first Oberman, the whole situation. If I understand this correctly, Ed Schultz was called into the office and threatened with being fired and broke into tears. It's somewhere on the internet, okay. And if I understood you correctly, Comcast is trying to buy MSNBC, and if so, I can't imagine Comcast keeping the same tone with these, with Oberman and Schultz and so forth. Point two, unemployment. I think you mentioned that the gentleman, wherever, Maryland, was offered a job at $13.50 an hour. Doing the math very quickly, that's $26,000 a year if it's a 40-hour-a-week job. I can't imagine anywhere in this country anyone receiving $26,000 off of unemployment. This whole debate about unemployment pays more than jobs. It may in a few situations with very low-paying jobs. But someone needs to do the math and do some statistics on this. I think it's totally blown out of proportion. And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Paul Jay?
It might be blown out of proportion, but I'm just saying I'm talking to a real guy who's giving me some real-life experience. In fact, he votes Democrat. He comes from Massachusetts. I don't think he's trying to make some propaganda point. He's just talking about what's going on in his plant.
And the point you were making, if I understood it, Paul Jay, wasn't that the unemployment paid the same amount, but it paid a significant enough percentage of it so that it was just as workers would rather stay put and try to get a better job down the road.
Yeah, I mean, the unemployment, if I understood it correctly, was about the unemployment insurance was something like about $8 an hour, and they're offering 13 and a quarter. So let's see. So now you've got to travel to work and pay your gas and pay your car costs. You may have to pay daycare. You know, how much are you netting differently from 13 and a quarter from $8? Plus, you know, you may want a break. So I don't think it explains the unemployment problem. I think it's clear we are in a deep recession, and there are not enough jobs for the number of people looking. But there may be, and in this case I think there was, some examples of where there may be some jobs going. The problem is how low wages have become. The problem is that a wage that what I said in the beginning, if my math is correct, and if someone can check it, and if I'm wrong, I did it pretty quickly just before the interview. But if it's true that in at the same factory was the guys were making people were making $10 an hour in 1970. And they should be making $55 an hour now. You can imagine what $13.25 is. So I think the problem is more the wage difference. The wages are so low; they're way too close to what unemployment insurance is. It doesn't explain why there's unemployment, though. I'm not suggesting that.
Paul Jay, our guest today in Media Matters. We've got about 10 minutes left. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We can take another call or two if someone likes. In the meantime, Paul, there's one of the issues I know that you've covered and you have an interest in. That is one of, I think, is as much a third rail issue in American politics and American media as any, which is the case of Israel and Palestine. And just talk a little bit about how the Real News Network approaches that and how it is different from most of the conventional news media in the United States.
Well, it's probably, in terms of foreign policy, at least the issue where there is the most pressure on journalists not to speak openly or fact-based truth as they can. And maybe the firing of Helen Thomas was one of the best examples of it. I mean, why on earth did the White House Press Association have to come out with a statement condemning and disassociating themselves with what one journalist said, who happened to be covering the White House. In the I've talked to now several people in the White House Press Association. Apparently, in the history of the White House Press Association, they have never disassociated themselves from anything anybody said or did. I mean, if you want to start looking up who said and did something, how about people that bought into the weapons of mass destruction argument that led up to the killing of hundreds of thousands of people? You know, if you want to disassociate yourself from something, why don't you start there? Although I think they have no business starting anywhere. They should shut their mouths and not be commentators on what journalists are saying or not saying. But the fact that they felt they had to.
But Paul, let me interrupt this. Some of our listeners might not be familiar with what Helen Thomas said, just for the sake of those who might not
okay,
be.
Okay, so Helen Thomas, just quickly, was the White House correspondent for the Hearst newspaper chain. She's about almost 90 years old and had been covering the White House since Kennedy. She was walking out of the White House and was just sort of in the park in front of the White House, and a guy who turns out to be a conservative rabbi stuck a video camera in front of her face and said, "What do you think of Israel?" And she said, "They should get the hell out." And I may be not remembering this word for word, but essentially she said that the Palestinian people's rights had been violated, and she used the phrase, "get the hell out." And so that became a great big deal because, and then he said, "Well, where should they go?" And she said they could go back to Germany, they could go to Poland, they could go to America. And so that became Ari Fleischer, Bush's former press secretary, started a thing on Huffington Post, and then some other people that are involved in vigorous support for the Likud representatives of Israel got in on it and started a big campaign to get Helen Thomas fired and kicked out of the White House press corps. And they tried to suggest that she was somehow saying that Jews should go back. The inference was go back to Germany of Hitler's time, which she never said. I mean, I really would challenge, I wish I had the money to do a survey right now, how many Israeli Jews have offered the same deal settlers are being offered in the West Bank. In other words, go to Germany or Poland and we'll give you a house, subsidy, language training, and a job. I'd like to see how many hundreds of thousands of people don't sign up for it. Anyway, we're actually going to be running a new Helen Thomas interview next week. And we asked her to kind of clarify what she said. And she made clear she meant occupied territories of, outside the 1967 borders. She didn't mean Israel itself, although she certainly does think it was not just that the Israeli state was founded on the kind of land it was founded, at least, back in 48, that the majority of people living in the area were not Jews. And she doesn't think the way the state was formed was justified, but she doesn't suggest now that the 67 borders of Israel should be challenged. But at any rate, it's an indicative of the what goes on in the media on this issue that the White House Press Association had to jump on board. I mean, everybody knows that has been there or knows a single thing about this situation is that Israel is the occupier. The UN says the Israel is the occupier of the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights. Everybody knows the human rights abuses. Any journalist knows the war crimes that were committed on the attacks on Gaza and so on and so on and so on. But there is this thing in the air. There is this pressure journalists feel. And it's not just the Zionist lobby. I mean, it's not just the AIPAC and there's something else. There's this fear of being, it may be that there is a fair amount of anti-Semitism. I mean, I think this is something that's not talked about very much. Because a lot of critique of Israel, while not all criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, some is. And there is a lot of hatred of Jews in American society. And it's, has hundreds of years of history here. And maybe there's a bit of this not knowing what to say without sounding anti-Semitic, that people have that sort of hatred of Jews. And this gets played on. It's a complex of factors. But at The Real News, we go where the facts lead us, and we don't care if someone calls us anti-Semitic or not. And I have to tell you, it's interesting. that I wrote this thing in defense of Helen Thomas right after this happened. To their credit, HuffPost put it on the homepage and went viral and had thousands and thousands of views and thousands of comments. And the vast majority of comments were in supported what I said. And the Washington Post did a poll asking whether Helen Thomas should get her job back. And apparently something over 80% of people said yes, she should get her job back. So I think to a large extent journalists are even out of touch with what most Americans feel on this. I think most Americans would like a more objective, rational, fair, just position on all of this.
One of the issues that you've covered, Paul Jay, at TheRealNews.com, the Real News Network, that has gotten some attention in the United States, but not very much, has been the enormous amount of protest around the world to the budget cuts, the economic crisis, the cutbacks that are being made in pensions and working people's living standards. In particular, probably the place that gets the most attention that I've seen is France, where you've been covering that continually for the last several weeks. You know, what's going on that these really huge upheavals barely get any mention in our news media, yet when I go to Real News Network, they're there?
Well, I mean, I think clearly, well, first of all, for a lot of the news media, nothing exists outside of the American borders anyway. Second of all, the idea that people might start doing it here, I think is taken very seriously by the elites in America. I think they're very, very concerned that American workers are going to wake up, and they're not going to be waking up drinking tea. What happened at the Toronto G20, and then what happened at the G20 before that in Pittsburgh and some of the other places where there have been protests, but I guess the most recent is in Toronto, and we did a lot of coverage because at the G20, the 20 heads of state all came to a deal, which is to half their deficits by 2013, which means everybody signed on to the austerity regime, including President Obama. They allowed for some short-term stimulus in the very near future, but everybody agreed in the longer term meaning, just a couple of years, that austerity would be the thing. And that means an attack on primarily people's pensions, Social Security. That seems to be where they're going to focus, on raising the age of retirement and going after quote-unquote entitlement programs that affect retired people, although there's also other kinds of discussions going on, including in the United States a goods and services tax, which will hurt ordinary people's incomes obviously more than it does rich people.
Sounds like some good news stories here.
Yeah, so we're doing all of this. But the thing that's very important out of understanding what happened at G20 in Toronto is that over 1,000 people were arrested. There may be 150 people involved in breaking some windows. It's fairly clear now that the police made a decision to stand down and allow people involved in what's called the black bloc tactic to break windows. They left some police cars essentially abandoned in right on the route where they knew this black bloc gang group of people, 150 people, they wear black masks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They left them there for the cars to get burnt, and of course they did get burned, and then those images on TV became the rationale for arresting 1,000 people who had absolutely nothing to do with this.
Paul Jay, unfortunately I hear the band tuning up in the background, and that means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Okay, go ahead. Do I have 20 seconds?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, very quickly, the chief of the Toronto Police Force is on the White House Advisory Committee on Domestic Security. The deputy chief of the Toronto Police Force is chair of the Advisory Committee for the FBI Academy. There is a North American strategy to suppress dissent, and we're going to do a lot more on this story.
And the place to go to see Paul Jay's work is TheRealNews.com or The Real News Network. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you, Paul Jay, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kyle Kroha, thank you for engineering. Melissa Trentz, my phenomenal producer, for arranging the show. I'll be back, everyone, 167 hours. Have a great week.